From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we meet the Flash Knights, a local couple that illuminate abandoned places through photography. And while Wisconsin's dairy scene has long been synonymous with cows, some creameries are bucking these traditions.
Most of the cheese does come from cows, which is to be expected. But what I found in researching this book is there's a growing number of goat and sheep's milk cheese producers.
Our family recipe series learns how to make tortilla de patatas, or a Spanish omelet.
Listen, a family recipe is in your heart, and it brings you memories that nothing can do. So if you change it, it won't bring you the same memories.
Plus, essayist Mel Miskimmin explores her love of the Outlander books. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Imagine it's pitch dark out and you're driving down a road in the middle of nowhere. Then you see an abandoned structure and you decide to go exploring. Well, that's what Chris and Katie Robleski do with their night photography. They call themselves the Flash Knights, and for half of the year, they're out investigating abandoned structures in the dark and illuminating history. With just a full moon, a flashlight, and long exposure photography, they turn lost Americana into unique art, usually while trespassing. The Milwaukee natives joined me in the studio while they were on their winter break before the coronavirus pandemic. Chris Robleski starts by explaining how he became interested in night photography.
15 years ago, I was just kind of wanting a challenge and needed to get out. I had lost my parents, and I thought, what better way to go out at night with a flashlight in a freezing cold? It was January 1st, 15 years ago. Actually, this is my 15-year anniversary of doing it, and I liked the challenge of it. And fast forward 5 years, I met Katie via the internet.
The magic of dating sites.
Yeah. The magic of dating sites. And
I had seen his work. Obviously, he introduced me to, this was back when Flickr was a thing, and he sent me his Flickr site. I was like, oh, man, this is so cool. He's like, yeah, let's, I'll show you how to do it. And we got into this train yard. He gave me this Vivitar flash and a little purple gel over the top. And he's like, head on into the train, and then just keep pressing this button. And so I did, and I came out of the train, looked at his little LCD screen on his camera, and I was just, like, hooked. It was so cool.
And I suppose that says a lot about both of your personalities. That's like, hey, you want to go to an abandoned so-and-so, and just take this, flash this for a while, I'll tell you when to come back.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned you just use a simple flashlight. Is that the extent of the tools that you use for these night shoots?
Yeah, we go out during full moons, so we need an external, other than just our flashlight, otherwise it would just be really dark imagery. There's a lot of timing and science stuff that we kind of mow through and just kind of like create the art on the other side of the camera. But yeah, we started out with simple flashes and then flashlights. And then a guy in San Francisco created this flashlight that has multiple colors, every color under the rainbow, in fact, called Proto Machine. And we use that now because we used to put these little colored gels like you'd see in a theater. Bands have them over their lights so you can see their colored stage show. But we'd always lose them and they'd fall off somewhere or they'd get all crumply and create these weird colors. So we morphed into this flashlight and now we just basically have a camera, flashlight, and then hopefully a full moon. But that doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Chris mentioned adversity and there's a lot that has to do with the weather, for example. Usually we go out during clear skies so you can get star trails because of the long exposure. You can kind of see the way the Earth's moving and the star trails in the sky. This one time we drove, it's 4 hours from here down in Illinois, and clouds were starting to roll in, but we had already paid $5 in tolls. So we're like, ugh. And we were just like, let's just check out the house because we'd never seen it before. And most of the time when we roll up on these places, we don't see them in the daylight. They're just, it's pitch black when we get there. And we got there, and just with some experimentation, like Chris said, with the flashlight that we have because it's so powerful, we got like one of our best shots. And it was like pure cloud cover, no moon. Just by using the flashlight, it turned out to pretty cool.
And so, you only need one in these buildings, or do you just kind of play it by ear and set up multiple?
It's just one. So it's basically me going inside. Like, Chris is the camera guy. He's like the composition man. And then I'm the light painter. And I go inside and I go from room to room to room, just lighting up each of the rooms. So it's a quick, like, depending on how much ambient light we have, it can be like a minute to 5 minutes. But sometimes a minute to do a two-story house, I'm just booking it through, like, up these stairs that have no banister. There's like holes in the ground, like holes in the floor. And it's pitch black again because I can only use the flashlight so many times, so I don't show up.
Okay.
So it's like a whole ordeal. It
takes, so you're doing it room to room as quickly as you can mm-hmm. to get that full image
yeah,
captured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some of these buildings do not look very structurally sound.
No.
So do you scope out before you go in and paint the light? Do you like say like, okay, here's kind of like my running route, so to speak?
If we're lucky, I can do that. Like if you're not trespassing. Yeah, sometimes we're dealing with like neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the middle of nowhere, you can hear just like every single step. And we've run into that before where neighbors are like, they come in their truck, their pickup truck with their dog on one side and probably a rifle on the other.
Right. I can't imagine it's a welcome sight to see like, what are all these strange lights going
yep.
on like
yep.
down on my
like
property?
Like the aliens have landed.
Yeah, we often wonder like, I wonder if we were driving by, what we would do? Would we stop if I saw a green or purple light coming out of a house? Or what I would just chalk that up to say, like, you know what, let's just move on and carry on with our day. But yeah, we usually walk together through with a bright white light before we set up. But even that doesn't show all the – we always go in with the less is more. Like, if you see a hole in the floor, you're probably going to be like, all right, there's the hole. Don't worry about the boards that are cracking to the hole and just kind of walk through there. And there is some adversity. That's what – we kind of like the challenge.
Yeah.
And it's preserving history, too, so –
Well, a little adrenaline with some history.
Oh, yeah, definitely, like. Yeah. Because any crick or crack, sometimes, like Katie was saying, the neighborhood dogs, those are the rural alarm clocks, if you will. And in the inner city stuff that we do, we don't really have to worry as much. But, you know, because people are like, oh, you're in East St. Louis, it's such a terrible place, or Detroit, it's such a terrible place, or Gary. And I'm like, nah, it's dark, we're inside of a building, they probably might even be frightened of us.
Like,
and I mean, I say they, I mean
here?
Just the neighbors or whoever's walking by.
They
got their own world to worry about. So we've only had one instance where someone was kind of frightening, but that was with
most times they come around when you explain like, hey, this is what we're doing, or
in South Dakota at a ghost town with I shouldn't say a ghost town, there's one guy living there, and it was a huge development for
it was like a ranch.
Yeah, a rancher. He's a rancher, and he heard us in the ghost town part where there's just like hundreds of cars and buildings and banks and stuff. So we were just like wandering around, and all of a sudden I saw this pickup truck and a dog, and I was like, okay. I go, Katie, why don't you go talk to him?
Like,
she's prettier.
Like an innocent lady.
Yeah, I was like,
threatening image.
Yeah.
But he was like, okay, whatever. Just have fun, I guess.
Sure.
He was probably thinking like, why are they taking pictures in the dark?
Yeah.
And then I don't know. We just had that ended up being fun when you have kind of a permission situation. But most times there's nobody anywhere near us.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm more worried about like wolves and coyotes and pheasants. Pheasants, I found out, are pretty vicious.
Oh,
they can
no.
like peck your shins apart while you're standing there. So and the cold weather. We've gotten really far down there in the temperatures.
So with these places, you know, you're going to the Dakotas, here in Wisconsin, elsewhere, how do you find or scope out these locations? Because I imagine they're not exactly on a map. They're not like your fiberglass oddities that are kind of roadside attractions or things like that. So how do you find them? What attracts you to them?
I do a lot of Google satellite earthing. Some people will not tell me them. So I do get a lot of intel from other people. They're like, all right, I know this place. And then sometimes I see a picture and I'm like, oh, this would be really cool at night because it's like an old gas station in the middle of a New Mexico desert. And I mean, when I was looking for it, all I saw was a silhouette and I was hoping that it was the building. So I parked off the road. There was a cattle gate and I hiked about a mile in and I was like, this is it, you know, but I had no intel other than just
like zooming in from like
zoomed
Google.
In from Google Earth. Yeah. And I, you know, if the roof is missing, obviously no one's there because, you know, what would they be? Because there was a house right next to it. But I was confused where the road was. So it was kind of like the intrigue of doing it. But I did it at 3 a.m. with a guy from Texas. And I was getting pretty tired, and he was getting pretty tired, and then he was losing interest in doing it. But it was kind of like the white whale because it was there's no road to it or anything. So I use Google Earth a lot. People give us tips and pointers, and sometimes we just happenstance upon them.
Yeah. Dakotas, for sure.
North and South Dakota.
Driving around.
Wyoming.
Yeah.
Well, and how great that your profession gives you that flexibility to stumble upon your next shoot.
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
for sure. Our GPS is just chock full of all the places we see like during the day. And we're like, oh, now for next time, for next time. As yeah. long as you don't get your GPS stolen out of your car.
Which did happen just down the road from here.
Yeah. Oh.
But yeah, and then we like kind of the other part of the is that we have a lot of time to kill in the day. And we try to visit in town. However small it is, because we have no fears there either. If we're going in buildings in the dark, we have no fear. So we try to find some like small town people to talk to and then, you know, drink, have a beer or some
yeah.
food or whatever. Being vegetarians in the middle of the prairies gets to be a challenge.
Yep.
So, but,
yep.
but the people are really nice. Everywhere we go, they're always like, kind of like, what do you do? And
I'm like, sometimes
they're like, this is a living. And I'm like, yeah.
And sometimes they remember us. We went to North Dakota again, like the next year, and we stayed in the same little motel, little mom and pop motel. And we told her, oh, we're just in photo, we're taking these photos at night. And she's like, I remember you from last year. And we're just like, what? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess like taking photos at night. Yeah.
Yeah. How many people like talk about flashlights and photos?
Right.
So it's kind of nice. So we've built like a rapport with some of these people because we want to be on the good side of.
Yeah, because it's technically can be trespassing sometimes.
Yeah, so we try to like get as much permission, but most of the people or places we go, as mentioned, other than some of the inner city stuff, I've done some pretty scary things in Detroit. Not the people, it's the buildings are scary because yeah. they're like dark hallways of
just crumbling.
Crumbling, and like I probably shouldn't be in here, but there was a hotel in Gary, Indiana, which they took down. And I went to the top and went on the roof. And I know I'm older, so I was like, I probably shouldn't be doing this. But I met her, and then that made me not do as many crazy
things. Okay, you go
do it.
Yeah. Like, now I don't do as many crazy things.
Sure. And that's kind of how it came about because he didn't have health insurance when we met. He was just, you know, kind of like a freelance guy. And I was working at, like, Kohl's or something. And so I was like, you can't go in there anymore. I'm going to do it. I've got the health insurance in case somebody breaks their leg or whatever.
Perfectly logical. Well, and you mentioned that, you know, these things they don't look good. You know, upon first glance and inspection, but then adding the dynamic of the different colored lights and the night exposure, you know, makes them into beautiful photographs and art pieces.
Thank you.
And with some of the photos that our listeners can see online, I particularly am drawn to the Painted Desert Trading Post, Old Route 66, Arizona. You know, because that you can kind of see, like, here's a smaller building, and then you can see the bones furthermore on the inside. You see the plaster coming off the walls. You see the old ads on the outside and just those hidden gems. So when it comes to that one or any of the others that are on our website, what kind of memories do you associate with them?
Painted Desert is
crucial.
That is, you know, thanks for pointing that out. Route 66 was near and dear to us. We've traveled it many times, but that in particular it's not a drivable section. So we had to park our car at a gate, another cattle gate, and then hike the fence and walk 3 miles into the Painted Desert on the old stretch of Route 66. So for that one, that's extremely memorable. That's one of our most memorable, like, long exposure, you know, things that we've done because, you know, when you're walking out and you hear nothing, you know, being in the city, you know, we're right in the city of Milwaukee. So when we get to get out and there's like nothing but a blanket of stars above you, there's no sounds. You can barely
except for those snoring cows.
Yeah, we heard snoring. We heard snoring cows.
We weren't sure what it was. They were like, oh, it's just the cows. It's okay.
Yeah, there's like a tiny viaduct with like, I don't know, 20 cows just snoring away. And I thought, I wonder if they're going to wake up because cows are pretty cool at night, but cattle, like the bulls, are not. So those are kind of frightening to be I've been warned about that from ranchers and such. They're like, don't go walking out with the bulls because they get crazy and territorial. But that was like a very memorable, just because it was such a long hike. I left wearing shorts because it was 70, shorts and a t-shirt, and not knowing that the high desert drops almost 40 to 50 degrees. We were running back to the car
because
I was like, oh my God, I have shorts and a t-shirt on. It's like 35 degrees.
Running out. To stay warm.
I was like, oh my God, I'm so cold. And I'm like, but we're in the desert. And then you wake up the next day, it's 100. You're like, this is a really weird thing.
Yeah. With going out and having such a drastic different experience finding these photographs versus when you're coming back, editing, traveling to art shows, interacting with people, do you find that it's the perfect balance? Because to be so immersed in your work in two different ways, that your time in the desert together, in nature, alone, nothing but cows and stars around you, that it feeds you in a good
it
way.
It does. It's the perfect, you know, 6 month to 6 month kind of repetitious cycle that we do. The summer can be brutal. The shows, kind of like Chris said, with the 100 degrees, we did a show in Des Moines last summer, and it was above 100. It was like a heat index of 112 or something. And you're sweating it out on the concrete and talking to thousands of people, and you're just like, and we're not particularly extroverted, so there's that too. So you're just kind of wiped by the end of the season. But then we transition into the shooting all winter, and it is quite the nice balance.
Yeah. Why do you think people should appreciate this? I imagine people come in around at the stands at the art fair, they're not seeing photography like this. And what
that
are some people's
sure.
misconceptions or, you know?
That it's Photoshop. Every single time. And we have a giant sign. The signs have gotten progressively bigger and more there's a multitude of them that says no Photoshop, because everybody comes in and they say, oh, I thought this was all on the computer.
So that's one of the things, that being in the public eye as opposed to like a gallery or a museum, we have nowhere to hide. So we're in a 10 by 10 tent. Mm-hmm. It's usually hot. People, for the most part, have been blown away because they're like, wow, you don't use Photoshop, because our editing, we don't do anything unless there's like a dramatic swear word that we're like, you know, I really like the composition.
Let's take the graffiti out.
Let's take the graffiti out. Yeah. So that's about the extent of our editing. But everything is pretty much natural. I was inspired by photographers, O. Winston Link. He just put a piece of film in there, and then that was the end of it for his photograph. No, like, darkroom craziness or whatever. So, we love to see the effect of, we had a gentleman buy a picture for his very young son, and he like treasures it. He's like, we had this picture where we drew a door with light in the dark, and he was like so blown away by it. And so the reaction that we get is usually very, it's humbling to me, because I never had any intention of showing people this work other than just putting it on the internet. And I definitely never thought about having it be a career.
And shows and stuff.
Yeah, and then people just, it's usually like, they're either blown away. Occasionally we'll get the scoff where they're like, ugh, and they think it's Photoshop, and then they walk away, but I can't catch up to them to tell them, no, we're just using light and moonlight and light. So that's basically all of our work, is just flashlight, moonlight, and a lot of patience.
Well, if the story isn't intriguing enough for people, I encourage them to look up just some of these photos and get captured even more. So, Chris and Katie, thank you so much for coming in to share your story.
Thank you so much. This is awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Katie and Chris Robleski are the Flash Knights. They joined me in the studio back in January, and you can find more information about them at wuwm.com. Coming up next, we'll talk with the author of a new cookbook featuring recipes from some of Wisconsin's most beloved creameries. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's hard to deny Wisconsin's love of cheese. Our nickname is America's Dairyland. We produce more cheese than any other state, and Wisconsin is home to some of the most award-winning cheesemakers in the world. Many of these creameries are featured in the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook, which takes a deep dive into the state's rich dairy history and highlights recipes from creameries throughout the state. Christine Hansen is the author of the cookbook, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the book and the origins of Wisconsin's dairy industry.
If you look at a lot of the cheesemakers, particularly in Greene County and Monroe area, they are now maybe on their third or fourth generation of cheesemaking, but they learned those skills from their ancestors who came from Switzerland. So we can thank Switzerland for all of our wonderful cheese today.
It's funny, my boyfriend is from Greene County. He's from Monroe, Wisconsin, and we just went to Cheese Days this past year, which also makes an appearance in the back of your book.
Yes, yes.
As one of the many events surrounding cheese in the state of Wisconsin. And I was surprised by how Swiss they really are. You know, they really identify as being Swiss there.
Absolutely. If you drive down or walk, because it's quite small, New Glarus is downtown, you might actually think you're in Switzerland. It's pretty cool. There's a bakery, there's, of course, beer, and there's a real sense of a place farther than Wisconsin.
So I know that there were a lot of cultures that really impacted dairy in the state. What are some of the, you know, non-Swiss cultures that were also big in cheesemaking?
Sure. Well, Italy also has a big cheesemaking tradition, and Belgiosio up in Green Bay in the 70s, the president and founder of Belgiosio Cheese came over from Italy, and same story as the Swiss. He had cheesemaking in his blood, literally. And that's the story there. And what's interesting about that creamery in particular is that the cheesemaker he brought with still works at the creamery. And I was just so tickled to meet him on my visit up to the creamery.
So when you, which is amazing, by the way, but when you look at like Italian cheesemaking, Swiss cheesemaking, and I'm assuming German cheesemaking, what are the differences there?
What's interesting is there's not a lot of differences. It's not like just one country would say, you know, we make goat cheese and we do it the best. It's very different from the wine industry, which is what my background is in covering. So, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon grapes might not do well in a particular state or country and do well in others. But with cheese, it really seems to be, you know, as long as you have a really good fresh milk source, one that you can access within a couple hours. And that's why Wisconsin cheese is so amazing, because it's not just like Switzerland, it goes back to the cows. So all of these cheesemakers are using milk either from their property or neighbor's property. They're not even traveling across the state with it, which is different than you can say for a lot of other food and agricultural industries.
Yeah. When we talk about the cheese that's coming out of Wisconsin, I think most people go, well, cow milk is what's making cheese here. But what is the breakdown? How much of our cheese is coming from cows? How much comes from goats, sheep?
Most of the cheese does come from cows, which is to be expected. But what I found in researching this book is there's a growing number of goat and sheep milk cheese producers. Sheep's milk is still pretty small. You'll find that more so in the Driftless region of part of the state. Two creameries in my book, Nordic Creamery, and another one I talked to but did not profile in the book, Hidden Springs Creamery. Those two are two good examples of sheep's milk. And then goat's milk seems to be rising in popularity, too. And I think that also has to do with our palates and, you know, as foodies or home chefs, what we like to cook with and what we're seeing chefs cook with.
What's the difference in the flavor profile that you're going to have in those kinds of cheeses?
Sure. Well, it was interesting when I was reporting this book and visiting with the creameries, I found that my own understanding of cheese really evolved. Like, for example, like most people, I'm very much in love with fresh goat cheese, a chèvre, a log. And I knew that, obviously, that hard-aged goat's cheese existed, but I hadn't really tasted through the varieties. And La Claire Family Creamery up in Malone is a great example. In fact, those cheeses made by the daughter of the founders have won a lot of awards, not just here in the States, but internationally. And those are hard goat's milk cheeses as well.
What does a hard goat cheese taste like versus, you know, a hard cow cheese?
Sure. A lot of times you can't really taste the difference. And I think that really speaks to the skill of the cheesemaker and that they're trying to hit a certain flavor profile. I have to believe that a lot of these cheesemakers have food in mind when they're making these recipes. While there's nothing wrong with having a block of cheddar, a block of goat's cheese, or what have you, it's also fun to play around with different recipes.
This book features a number of different creameries around the state of Wisconsin. We're not just looking at the southern part or the northern part, but really, you know, the whole thing. What were some of your favorite creameries as you went around the state? And what were some that really stuck out to you?
Sure. Well, that's a difficult question, of course, because you're asking me to choose not only my favorite creamery, but my favorite cheese, maybe. But in terms of experiences, I really was impressed with two in particular that have a very strong visitor experience. So La Claire Family Creamery, they have goats you can see and perhaps even pet on property. I was so thrilled to see a day-old baby goat. As a person who lives in the city and did not grow up on a farm, I was just so tickled by that. They also have attached to the creamery, which you can view through glass walls, a cafe where you can enjoy different food items prepared with their cheeses. So it'd be easy to spend a couple hours there. A similar experience I saw is up at Door County Creamery in Sister Bay. They have goat yoga, which is currently very trendy. They have what I like to think of as a very Sonoma type experience. I've spent a lot of time in Sonoma. And what you can do is taste the cheeses while looking at the goats on the pasture. I mean, it really doesn't get any more authentic farm to table than that.
Goat yoga sounds like it might be fun. Cow yoga, on the other hand, that could get dangerous.
I did not come across that in my research, and I probably would not recommend it.
So this book is full of a lot of different recipes. How did you curate them? Because I'm sure, you know, every creamery is going to have a dozen favorite recipes with their cheese. It's something that they work with every day, and most of them for their entire lives.
Well, I really, when I approach the creameries, I try to get them to think not just about what recipes you're releasing on your website or in your product brochures or at trade shows or chefs or whatnot. I really wanted them to think about, you know, what do you make at home with your cheeses? And maybe it's something that is not a written down recipe. It's in your head. Okay, let's work together to write it down. One great example is Belgiosio. They have the La Casata cake is something that the family enjoys every Easter in the spring. And then Sid Cook at Car Valley, one of the recipes that he provided is actually that of his 101-year-old mother. It's an apple pie with a sharp cheddar crust.
I noticed that recipe. I remember a long time ago hearing about a law in Wisconsin that you had to serve apple pie with sharp cheddar. It was this kind of joke thing that was on the internet. And it's such an interesting combination. What is that? It's such like a Wisconsin thing, that the sharp cheddar with apple pie.
Well, they both have, you know, some high acidity, and they just seem to work really well together. I mean, a lot of times you will see apples on cheese plates, chopped up apples along with other fruits. It makes sense.
One of the things I found very interesting about this book was it really didn't shy away from sweet. I think, like, when you get into Cheeseland, a lot of people think savory, but you have a lot of sweet recipes.
Exactly. I think we all know that cheese can be used to make mac and cheese, grilled cheese sandwiches, pizza, and all of those things are wonderful and things I enjoy on a regular basis. But I wanted to really have some dessert recipes. The apple pie we just talked about is one example. Another example is goat cheese brownies, which was provided by La Clara Family Creamery. And Door County Creamery as well, they have a chocolate dish with goat cheese that is super delicious. And so I wanted to really think about cheese as being a 24-hour ingredient. Not that you're going to stay up all night eating cheese, although that might actually be fun, and I would totally
do
that.
Done it before.
Exactly. Let's admit it. But thinking about, okay, in breakfast, maybe you want a Mediterranean quiche with cheese or biscuits, and then for lunch, a salad or flatbread. And then dinner, of course, there's the traditional recipes, but so much more. I have a recipe for cornmeal crusted fish tacos. The cheese that's used with that has a mango habanero flavor, and that gives it a really nice bite.
We've already talked about, of course, the cultures that informed sort of our origins of cheese. But one of the people you profiled I thought was very interesting, her journey to cheese. Huma Siddiqui, am I saying her name
yes,
right?
Yes,
Huma Siddiqui. Tell me a bit about her story.
She, I actually found online. I mean, the power of the internet. I just kind of searched for different cheesemakers because I had not tried her cheese before. It's pretty limited distribution, but she's based in Madison, and she is from Pakistan. So she's a really great example of a female entrepreneur, and the spices that she uses in her cheeses are, I mean, normally you would see those spices in the recipes from her native country, but she's added them to the cheese. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and an interesting approach, mixing what is her home country with, you know, a very Wisconsin staple.
Exactly. I mean, she could easily make orange cheddar and call it a day, right? But she decided to have her own flavor, literally, in her cheese line.
The book actually introduced me to a couple recipes that I'd never heard of. One of them was, I'm going to massacre this, gougère. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, like a choux pastry with cheese.
Yeah, we can thank the French for those. They're delicious.
And choux in general.
Right.
And you mentioned this before, La Cassata. So I Googled that, and it's this terrific looking Italian cake with all of this, you know, accoutrement on the top.
Right, exactly. And that's from Belgiosio, which, as are all the recipes in my book, include the cheesemaker's products. So literally, you know that Belgiosio has all those products that are dairy-related, at least. But also, you know, there are going to be cases where maybe you can't find a particular cheese based on where you're shopping. And what I like about this book is that it's okay to use another blue cheese or another cheddar, particularly if you're listening and you're not in Wisconsin or Illinois or Iowa or Minnesota at all.
And they may not have them there.
Right, right.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Christine Hansen is the author of the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook, Creamy, Cheesy, Sweet, and Savory Recipes from the State's Best Creameries. She spoke with Lake Vex Joy Powers in March of last year. After the break, we'll go from cheese to another favorite staple, potatoes. Lake Effect returns with family recipes in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In our family recipe series, contributing producer Lucian Jung visits the kitchen of local residents as they prepare special family dishes they remember from childhood. And we should note, this was recorded before the coronavirus pandemic and the stay-at-home orders. For this episode, Elena Bisabaros shares her recipe for tortilla de patatas, also known as a Spanish omelet. This is a savory cake of whipped eggs mixed with fried potatoes and onions and cooked on the stovetop until golden brown. It's a simple recipe, but the preparation is not without drama. Flipping the thick and heavy omelet from the hot pan requires conviction and a bit of daring. But with patience, skill, and a touch of bravery, you can master this recipe too. Tortilla de patatas is found on dinner tables and tapas bars throughout Spain, and the smell of olive oil-infused potatoes and sweet onions always transports Bisabaros back to the little town where she grew up.
I was born in a beautiful place in the northern part called San Sebastian. San Sebastian, it belongs to the Basque country.
What is unique about Basque culture that makes it different from Spain?
Basque people have such a profound identity, let's say, because Basque is one of the oldest languages in the world. Of course, the culture, the music, the philosophy, so it's totally different than Spanish.
So in your household, you spoke Basque?
Well, I grew up under the dictatorship under Franco, right? Spain had a civil war between 1936 and 1939. So after that, Franco, a general, took over the country and We had a dictatorship until 1975 when he died. So in some houses, they would speak it. In some houses, they wouldn't because it was forbidden. And you would go to jail if you spoke it.
You would go to jail if you spoke Basque.
Yeah, many people went if they heard them speaking it. So the main language, it was Spanish. You couldn't speak anything else in any part of the country.
What did it mean to you to live under a dictatorship? Because you were born into one. When did you have a sense of what that meant?
Well, when you grow up, you don't realize where you are. Later, you analyze how you lived. And I have to admit that, I mean, my childhood was extremely happy because I lived in a such a small town, the country. So when you are more like you get to your 12 to 18, something like that, that was the time of the end of the dictatorship at the beginning of the democracy where, although it was a peaceful transition, but there's no peaceful transition going from a dictatorship into a democracy ever. And my memories from high school, for example, going to San Sebastian, because there was no high school in my small town, many times there were demonstrations all over against the dictatorship. It was just buses all in fire, so I had to walk through a highway to go to my house. So
And this was when you were in high school.
Yes, when I was in high school. My memories from high school, it was all demonstrations, all fire, all fighting. I mean, I grew up in, you have no idea. It was very, very political and very dangerous sometimes.
On top of the political situation, I mean, you're a teenager. So
it didn't even matter. You have to take care of your own self to be safe in a really dangerous situation. So you don't think about what teenagers usually think. But it was very, I can tell you, very scary. I mean, nobody could. You couldn't leave your house. You didn't know.
Now, where did you go to university?
I went to the University of Salamanca. It's one of the oldest universities in the world. It goes back to the Middle Ages.
And where is that located?
Salamanca is west of Madrid, 2 hours west going from Madrid. Madrid is right in the middle of Spain, so you go towards your left, trying to go towards Portugal, and right in the middle of the way is Salamanca. It has a cathedral that is very old, and this big palace is called El Palacio de Anaya, where my classes were, and I truly believe that there's so much knowledge that the knowledge just fell into your head as you were in the classrooms, because it's a beautiful palace.
And was that your first time away from home?
Well, the first time. I mean, I think 16, I did some exchange in France because that's my second language. As we are in the Basque country, we are next to France. Part of the southern part of France is part of the Basque country. So many times when we go to the, we say, on va de l'autre côté du Pays Basque, we go to the other side of the Basque country to buy cheese, or le camembert, le brie. Oh. For us, France is sometimes we say it's closer than Spain because of the Basque country in France. So,
and particularly with food, it sounds like there's a lot of French influence.
No.
Oh, no?
Let's say that just the opposite. I'll say Basque food have influence French and Spanish cuisine, because we are older than both of them together.
I see. Okay. So what is characteristic of Basque cuisine?
Of course, we are in the sea, right? So most of the main dishes, I remember squid in its ink, in black ink, merluza en salsa verde, hake in green sauce is another one that is, when I go to the Basque country, I have to have my hake. Fresh anchovies. My mother always asks me, what would you like to eat when you come? And I always say the same thing, fried fresh anchovies with fried eggs.
Oh, and that's what you loved eating growing up.
Oh, God. It just brings me back to my childhood and to, because it's so good.
Now, is that what you're making today?
No, I'm so sorry. Here we cannot really find good fish.
So now, the recipe you're about to make is something that you grew up with? It's something that your mother made for you, or?
Right. I mean, even today, I call my mother. She's going to be 91 in a couple of weeks. And I said, Mom, when do we eat Spanish omelette? I want to make sure that I say it right. And she's like, every single night. It was the protein that I could give four children. We got the eggs with our potatoes.
Now, what's the name of this dish in Basque?
I mean, usually we just call it tortilla de patatas. It's an omelette, but then the traditional is with potatoes. You'll find it in every single counter, in every bar, as a tapa. And you ask any family, and they cook it all the time. But there's one thing that I have to say. You have to be patient. And it shows the kind of the Spanish way of being. We take time to do things. And when you go to Spain, time moves in a totally different way. Here, everybody's all the time running. And sometimes you don't know what you run for. In Spain, people can walk. So our philosophy of life is totally at a different speed. And I think the Spanish omelette shows you that in the method. You have to have patience and take the time to do it and wait until the potatoes are really done. Be patient.
The idea of essentially this is fried potatoes. Already you've got me. I mean, it sounds delicious.
Of course, they have to be fried very well and with the best olive oil that you can find. That's the main really secret. When you see the recipe, 1 liter of, I mean, it's like all that oil.
1 liter of oil, olive oil.
Olive oil, but then you strain it and you can use it later. My mom always had like a metal container where after doing the Spanish omelette, all the oil goes there. And that oil is going to be used for frying eggs the next day or cooking something else.
Well, I'm excited about trying this dish because oftentimes when I think about eggs, they're fried in butter.
Right, I know. And when you grow up in Spain, the butter is not existent ever. Everything is done with olive oil. So you have to understand that. And small pieces.
You're cutting the potato into kind of quarter-inch little cubes. So do you remember your mom at the counter cutting up potatoes like this?
All the time. We used to spend hours upon hours peeling. And me too, because being the only girl, you know, at one point I had to fight for my own rights. I was the only one who was helping until I said no more. I had to make my brothers to start doing some chores. But it took some fighting and some punishments and all of that. Even up to today, I'm the rebel of the family.
Well, it seems like the period in history that you were born in, I mean, how could you not have grown up to be the rebel?
Well, no, but some other people are not. They have 3 brothers and they are pretty mellow. They just follow the rule. I don't follow any rule. My best way of explaining it is I tell my children, if the masses are going one way, you turn back and go the other way. So that's my way.
So now you're just beating up about 6 eggs.
Right. So, and you have to beat them to the point that you see foam. So that's one of the secrets also. Sometimes you use, oh, it's too much work. It's enough. No. You really need to go on and
so
on.
So beat these eggs until they're nice and foamy.
And you always do it with a fork. You don't do it with those strange things. I don't know how you call them. The whisk. So you see, I really like it very, very foamy. Actually, with my children, he's like, Mom, I'm tired. No, you keep going. Just a little more. You need to see more foam. So if you talk to them, they remember that forever. It's like beating the eggs for the Spanish omelette. But yeah, this is almost done.
You've drained the olive oil out of the frying pan and just left a little bit on the bottom, and you're mixing up the potatoes and the onions and the eggs.
Right, you just kind of with your fork smash the potatoes into the eggs, because all of that is what you are going to pour into the pan. I just put the pan at, again, high. And when it's really high, this is a whole fast process. So you just pour it into the pan. Keep moving the frying pan so to make sure that nothing sticks in the bottom, but you want like a thick and a hard crust.
Oh, so you want a crust on the bottom.
Right. So now the magic comes. You put your plate, a bigger plate, and you kind of have to go one, two, and just turn it over.
Put a plate on top of the pan and you flipped it over.
And then you just go back again, because we are going to do the same process a few times.
It just smells so savory.
Oh, I love it. The smell of the Spanish omelette.
So now you've made this the traditional way with just the potatoes and the onion. Do you ever experiment and start adding chorizo or anything like that? Or do you like to have it just like this?
Listen, a family recipe is in your heart, and it brings you memories that nothing can do. So if you change it, it won't bring you the same memories. It has to be the original, the one that my mom made over and over and over, year after year. I mean, so I grew up with it, and I just love it.
I can't wait to taste this.
Well, I have a surprise for you. We are going to eat it with a nice glass of champagne. Would you like to have that?
Champagne?
Yes, usually Saturdays is my mimosa day. So usually I have my mimosa with some chorizo, some cheese, but today is Spanish omelette, even better.
My goodness, absolutely. Okay, so the omelette looks absolutely delicious, and you've got these mimosas going, and...
I brought my son, a 15-year-old, that has eaten his Spanish omelette since he was a baby.
Oh, really? So you're the expert on Spanish omelettes.
A little bit.
His name is Xavier, which is a Basque name. And he's 15 years old. He can tell you just a little bit his experiences in our family with the Spanish omelette.
So this is something that your mom makes all the time?
Oh, yeah. Spanish omelette I've been eating for a very long time.
So how would you describe the flavor?
I really like the potatoes with the onion. It gives it a good sweetness. I mean, I've also eaten this for a long time, and like this is kind of more American spin. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll have like ketchup with it as well.
How do you feel about that?
I don't like it, but that's the American way of eating a Spanish omelette. That's no, there's no question about that.
Okay, well, I can't wait to taste this here. Mmm. It's so savory. I think it's about the creaminess of the potato and the creaminess of the egg. It's really dense.
Right, that's what you need to create that kind of a cake that puts together the potatoes and the onion and the eggs, and it's all like simple ingredients that sometimes we forget about, that they are so wonderful.
Lucian Jung produces our family recipe series. He visited Elena Bisabaros to learn about the Spanish omelet back in March before the coronavirus pandemic. You can explore past segments at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then return with essayist Mel Miskimmon. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Some of us are caught up in the daily news cycle, waiting for new information about protests against police brutality, the upcoming presidential election, and of course, about the coronavirus pandemic that has drastically impacted our lives. But Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmon is not among these throngs of news junkies. Instead, Miskimmon has her sights set on 18th century Scotland.
I approached the information kiosk in the middle of the bookstore with a combination of apprehension and embarrassment as if I was going to ask for the sexually explicit section, which in a way I was, kind of. Do you have those Outlander books? The girl cursed the slowness of her internet connection, admitted, yes, she had them, and told me to follow her. She led me past the young adult section, past pets, past gardening. You know, there's a TV show, she said. Yeah, I know. I started watching, and I had to stop. Why? She said. I've heard it's pretty good. Yeah, it's good. A little too good. Let's just say I had a little break with reality. I told her that my husband had been out of town on business, and I was in a mood for a good binge-worthy series. My tastes usually default to quirky comedies, but the thumbnail of a man in a kilt, windswept hair, I thought, I'll give it a go. Yeah, I haven't been the same since. Twinges, tingles, and flutters that had been dormant, that I thought had left the building along with my collagen, had been awakened from a deep slumber thanks to the kilted hunk of burning Scott with a broadsword and a broad smile. I binged. It wasn't pretty. I went to bed thinking about the possibility of time travel. The books were on the lower shelf. She sat on the floor to find the right copy. I knelt. Perhaps that's why I felt like I could confess to her. I used to make fun of people who read romance novels, I said, or who were into Game of Thrones. But now, I have to reevaluate my whole worldview. And that's a bad thing? She said. She slipped the receipt inside the book and wished me happy reading. I distinctly remember, back in high school, my English teacher, Miss Jellin, gave the class an assignment to read a 500-page book in a week. I thought, what fresh hell? Different story now. I don't eat. I don't sleep. It's all I can do to remember to let the dog out. My husband comes home, and I'm knee-deep in heather, craving whiskey because in the book, they're always drinking whiskey. I read while wrapped in a plaid blanket because the characters are frequently cold and damp, and it's the closest thing I have to a kilt. I want to learn Gaelic, find out if I carry the gene for red hair. I haven't been on Facebook in weeks. I haven't checked the news headlines on my phone. I can't find the time to text people. I had been looking forward to the final season of Veep, but I haven't seen an episode yet. Despite the lack of indoor plumbing and antibiotics, or the threats of uprisings, or the possibility of being burned at the stake for witchcraft, 18th century Scotland is more appealing than 21st century America.
Mel Miskimmin is a Moth Grand Slam winner, author, and fixer-upper. You can hear more stories about her husband and her home on her podcast, Housebroken, available on Apple Podcasts. That's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.